The moment the SS noticed that there are seven dwarves, they knew that it would interest Mengele. In order to score points with him, they kept them aside and sent one of the soldiers to wake Mengele up.
That was Yehuda Koren on the sad story of a group of Holocaust victims.
They saw the Viking invaders very much as bloodthirsty wolves, these sort of animalistic base humans.
And that was Yanina Ramirez on the Anglo-Saxon view of the Vikings. But as we'll discover, relations between the two weren't just defined by bloodshed. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe for subscription deals. And we also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire and Google Play. For details of all of our digital formats, including price, content and availability, head to historyextra.com/digital. The stories of people with disabilities during the Holocaust are often harrowing. The Ovitz family, of which seven members were dwarves, were among those transported to Auschwitz, where they were subjected to often bizarre experiments. Yehuda Koren and Eilat Negev are the authors of a book documenting the family's experiences. They spoke to our reviews editor, Matt Elton, about their research.
Could you explain a little bit about the background to the Ovitz family?
Many books have the byline saying that it's remarkable, it's unique, extraordinary, and incredible. But we feel that this story is really one in a lifetime. We're all familiar with the legend, the fairy tale of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And we thought that, you know, it belongs to the Walt Disney World. And all of a sudden, we came across seven dwarfs in real life. And the Ovitz family from Romania, from Transylvania, which is in the north of Romania, is the largest family recorded. So in reality, it so happened that seven in the fairy tale is also the number seven in reality. So this is the largest recorded family of dwarves. The other thing, they were entertainers, and they had their own traveling theater and named it correctly the Lilliput Troupe. And the other thing which is really unique in their story, usually dwarves are part of a whole show, of a circus event, of a vaudeville show. They're coming along doing three or two songs and then disappear. They had the whole platform for themselves. I mean, they provided a two-hour program of songs, music, skits, and it's the only all dwarf company in the history of entertainment. And the third thing, which has really made the story remarkable, is the fact that what happened to them in the Holocaust. Jews were sent to the death camps, and they arrived at Auschwitz. And as a rule, one out of 10 people who arrived were sent to the camping site to do slave labor. Nine were sent immediately to the gas chambers. So in the history of a family, it's a miracle if one person survived a place like Auschwitz, let alone two. In their case, we are talking about the only family who entered Auschwitz and all the members, the seven dwarves and five of their entourage, which were other members of the family who were of average height, they all survived. So it's a miracle in that sense. And they were sent to the camp because they were Jews, but they survived because they were dwarves.
So how did you first find out about their stories?
Well, a few years ago, we read a footnote actually in a history book, which said that at the beginning of Israel in 1949, there was a group calling themselves the Lilliputs of Auschwitz, and that they were famous entertainers. It sounded odd to us, you know, that people will come to hear a group which had the Auschwitz in the, you know, in their title, in their commercial name. And the person who wrote the history book, he wanted to show that at the beginning of Israel, people talked very freely about the Holocaust, and only later they stopped, they became shy about it. So we went to the newspapers of the time, and we discovered that there was a troop, but it was called the Lilliput Troop. Auschwitz was not in the title, but so the historian had made a mistake, but that's what really started on our course. We found the family name Ovich, and looked through the telephone books, and there were about a dozen in Haifa, in the town where it was said that they came from, and we started phoning. And they think it maybe it was the seventh of eight people that you spoke to, and I was the one who was talking, because you know usually when a woman calls it, you are less suspicious. You don't think it's a burglar planning to enter your house. So I asked her, "Are you of the famous Ovich family who had the Lilliput troop?" She said, "Yes, I am. I am the last one." And they said, "We are journalists. We are writers. We would like to come and take your story." And she said, "By all means." And I think the next day we were already there, and that's how our journey started.
Thank you. So kind of heading back to the start of the story, what was their act like? What did it involve?
We're talking about a family. The father was involved, and he had from two wives. The first one died at a very young age. 10 children, 7 of them were dwarfed, and 3 were of average height. It's a remote part of Romania. It's still very remote nowadays. I mean, it's like the middle or the beginning, even of the 20th century. If you go to this place nowadays, there was no way that 7 dwarfs in a place like this could make a living out of you know cultivating the land. They couldn't do any other profession, like you know, being I don't know teachers or what have you, because they were shorter than the average kids of age 6. But they were beautiful and very musically talented. So it was their mother's suggestion that they will look for a profession which will enable them to be together, to live together, to make a living together, stay together in a way, support one another. And the stage seemed the perfect option. On stage, you are applauded. People honor you, respect you. You're not isolated. And that's how it all started. So they established their own group. They were playing on child-sized instruments, violins, a guitar, cello, and drums, and local instruments. And they combined a program of songs of the time, a lot of music, many love songs, very sentimentals, but also funny songs. And in between, there were skits. And they gradually started performing in the nearby villages. And with success, they expanded their horizons and traveled as far as Prague and Budapest. And it's a very remote place, and I can't believe how a person who was living in such a remote place could think about the whole world. I mean, people who live there now hardly went to Bucharest, maybe once in their life, and these people were thinking that the whole world belongs to them, and they more or less managed to conquer you know, quite a wide territory with their performances. And they stayed in the village throughout their life, and that was the base from... They emerge on their journeys, usually lasting 3 weeks. And then when the tour was over, they return to the village in a way to rest and then embark on the next tour. They've done everything themselves. I mean, they took care of, you know, preparing their costumes, their equipment, have written the repertoire. Everything was done by themselves, including, you know, managing and ordering the events, and they were in charge of the time schedule. And the interesting thing is that the average height members of the family, they were the one working behind the scene. The dwarves were at the front, and everyone else was behind the scene as dressers, drivers, porters, and what have you. And 4 of the female dwarfs got married, and their husband joined the company, and they worked in the company in various jobs. So it was kind of a communal life and a family enterprise.
So we've touched there about their life before the war. Did the outbreak of the war have much of an immediate impact on the family?
It's quite surprising that the outbreak of the war had no immediate influence on them. They had to change their identity cards, but somehow they managed to get cards which did not have the word Jew in it. So they continued working as before, because when the war started, there were anti-Jewish laws saying that Jews are not allowed to work with non-Jewish clients. For example, a doctor was not allowed to treat the non-Jewish patients. A lawyer could only work in the community, and artists could only perform to their own to their own religion. And of course, Jews were so poor and so so in difficult situation there that show business was not very much, it was not high on the agenda. There was no money to do it. So if they had only to rely on Jewish audience, they would have starved. So that's why it was so important to them to continue even to cheat the authorities in order to continue working with all audiences. And it was quite hard because they were observant Jews, so usually they did not perform on the Saturday, on Shabbat. So whenever but they couldn't say that they were Jews. So whenever there was a show scheduled for Friday night or Saturday, they would, of course, accept it and tickets would be sold. But then just a few hours before the show, there would be a note from a doctor from saying that due to the sudden illness of one of the members, the show is cancelled and postponed to Sunday. So it was they really had to work, between the covers. And then in 1944, when Hungary really invaded the place where they were living, they were taken with other Jews to the ghetto, and from there they were transported to Auschwitz, where they arrived on the 19th of May 1944.
Just kind of rewinding a little bit, you touched there on the fact that they avoided having, Jewish put on their identity cards. Do we know why that was?
Yes. It's again the thing that their number played for them. All seven of them with the beautiful dresses and makeup and voluptuous hair. They stormed the office of the bureaucrats in Budapest. And in a way, I think they confused the people who were working there with their appearance and their smiling, the cheerful presence, that they managed in a way to get an ID without stating that they were Jews. That's the story they told us, that they make a whole performance in the office, and the bureaucrats were nice to them and issued this certificate, which enabled them to perform for three more years. So we're talking about 1940 until March 1944. Europe was at war. Jews in their millions were killed, and they continued their life as usual. They said that they had an audience that waited for them, and they had to perform. They only canceled their tours in Czechoslovakia, which was under Nazi's occupation, but they could perform in Hungary and Romania. The only thing is they stopped, of course, performing on Sabbath Eve and on the holidays, but they also stop talking among themselves in Yiddish, so that they are not going to be recognized. So they put a whole show of that they are Romanians, and the moment they felt that there's some suspicious about their identity, they simply wiped the place from their map of performances. But still, they managed to drag on until Germany invaded Hungary, and then they realized that the game is over.
It's worth touching upon at this point. I mean, who did you talk to get the information in this book? Is it just one person or several people?
We talked to dozens of people, actually. From the family itself, there was just one survivor, Perla Ovitch. She was the youngest. She was born in 1921, and she was the one, the last one to die. So we spoke to her extensively. We also found people who were with them in the village, people who were with them at Auschwitz, people who knew them from other places. And we went to historical documents, for example, testimonies that the Germans took from camp survivors, not necessarily Jews, you know, in the early 1940s, or people who were at the camp or gave testimonies to the Frankfurt prosecutor for various reasons during the time, and they mentioned dwarves, they mentioned the Ovitch family, so we took these testimonies too, so it was we corroborated everything against the other. We found the documents in Germany and in Poland, so it was, it's really not a memoir of one person or one family even, but like a very multi-layered account.
What impact do you think the passing of the anti-Jewish decrees of 1944 had on the family's relationship with the other villagers? We've talked about how they always returned to the village in between their tours. Do you think the relationships soured as a result of this pressure from outside?
I don't think so. I think that they were all living in complete denial that a war is taking place far away from their place. If there were rumors, they dismissed it. If they were actually came across eyewitnesses to some of the horrors which were done by the Nazis, everybody was sure that these people are out of their mind and hallucinating and simply mad people. They lived in complete denial that the war is not going to reach their remote area. And it's amazing, but life for them continued as usual.
So can you talk me through what happened on the 15th of April, 1944?
On the 15th of April, they started their journey to Auschwitz. They arrived on the 19th. It is well known that the doctors, the physicians, who the Nazi physicians who were working in the camp, did the selection on the ramp, and it's one of the these doctors is the notorious Dr. Joseph Mengele, and nearly most survivors describe how he was standing there on the ramp and selecting people, the few, the very few, to life into the camp for labor, and the majority straight to the gas chambers. It so happened that on the night when they arrived, he was not on duty. He was fast asleep in his room at the SS camp. But the SS guard on the ramp knew of his collector mentality, that he was really selecting people with all deformities, tall people, obese people, short people. Everyone here has kind of a deformity. He was collecting it, and it was they were all kept in one place in the camp, which was known as Mengele's circus or Mengele's zoo. The moment the SS noticed that there are seven dwarfs, they knew that it will interest Mengele. In order to score points with him, they kept them aside and sent one of the soldiers to wake Mengele up. And again, I'm returning to the number seven. We believe that if they came on their own, separately, one dwarf in this transport, the other one in another transport, they would have been disappeared in the mass. Usually, it's, each train, each transport consisted of 3,000 to 400 to 4,000 people. So they wouldn't have been noticed if they came on their own in this in the chaos which existed on the ramp. But the fact that there were seven, it attracted their attention. And even if it was just one dwarf, I think that the SS wouldn't bother waking Mengele up for one dwarf. And we know that of cases where dwarfs arrived on their own and they were sent immediately to the gas chambers. But for seven dwarfs and other members of the family who were of average height, that seems a very safe reason to wake up Mengele, and this is exactly what happened. He came immediately when he heard that he had seven dwarfs waiting for him with more members of the families who were of average height. And when he saw them, he was delighted, and he said that I have now worked for 20 years.
There's some debate about a story in the book about how the family were almost gassed. What do you think actually happened?
The story, we've tried to approach quite an unusual approach to writing about the Holocaust, and that's adopt a critical approach, which means that to cross-examine every testimony. Usually when you hear a survivor testify about the horror that he went through, you just, you know, shrink in your chair, you cry with him, you bow your head to the horrors that he describes, and you don't question him, and you don't argue with him, or you don't doubt what he's describing. But we've decided that we want to check as much as one can every fact, every story, not only the stories that the family told us, but there were other stories that people told or said about the dwarves, and we wanted to check as one can do it. We were not in Auschwitz, thank God, but still we wanted to treat it as another history case that need to be checked. Perla, her sister, and three other members of the group described to us in details how they were taking to a building. Gas started. They were ordered to undress. There was gas coming out from the ceiling, and they were started fainting and shouting. And then all of a sudden, they heard a voice from outside crying, "Where are my dwarfs? Where are my dwarfs?" And the doors were open, and Mengele was at the door. And they felt that he was really their savior. He saved them from imminent death. So we had five testimonies, not just one, but we still decided that we are going to check it. And the way we did it is very eerie. We had to learn how to operate the gas chamber. And we read the German manuals and the orders of the camp in order simply to know how one operates the gas chambers. And we came to the conclusion that gas chambers were not operated on a small group of 20 people. If 20 people were to be to die in a place like Auschwitz, it was more economical for the Germans simply to shoot them. Gas chambers were operated on masses of people, 500, 2,000, not on a small group. And then there were other procedures that I don't want to go into. It was eerie enough for us to study it. How do you start? When can you stop? Who's going to stop? And we came to the conclusion that it wasn't, it couldn't have been a gas chamber. But we were sure that they were not inventing a story. Something happened to them that made them believe that it was a gas chambers. And we tried to look for what it might have happened. And we, we learned the whole structure of the camp. And we realized that what happened is that they were taken to a sauna for a disinfection. And when you are tired, and when you are a dwarf or a child, the effect of the heat which comes from the water is similar to that of the gas. And you can faint. If you have open wounds, you'll be suffering. So it was a sauna which really caused them to faint, and not a gas chamber. We wrote it in the book, and we described, and we have tried to explain why they came to this conclusion that it was a gas chamber, and we found that it is sauna. But we remembered the one of the lessons that we were taught by a very prominent professor of history of Holocaust studies, who said that whatever you're talking to a survivor, don't argue with him. So we didn't confront them with our finding and say, okay, you are not, what do you have to say about that? We simply wrote it in a book, leaving it to the reader to come to the more or less the same conclusion.
You touched there on the impact that all of this would have had on the family, which must have been huge. Do you think they had an awareness of why they were being spared death?
At first, they had no awareness why they were being spared death. but gradually it became known to them, because Mengele quite soon after admitting them into the camp, he began experimenting on them. So just about a week or two after being left alive, they began to be taken to the clinics and laboratories, where two, three times a week, blood was taken out of them in great quantities, because Mengele was trying to break the genetic code, and he thought that every information would be in the blood. They had to sit naked on benches for whole days until the first one was examined, and until the last one, because only when in the afternoon, where everything finished, they were taken back to their bark. Healthy teeth were plucked out of them, because he wanted to check the teeth and hairs and all kinds of psychological and physical tests, measurements, quite harrowing, and very often they fainted because they were hungry and cold. So it was, you know, so much blood was taken out of their small bodies that it was really hard. And when water was poured over them to awaken them, and then they continued their siphoning out their blood. So they began to understand what was their point, which was experimental subjects, guinea pigs for Mengele, and also they, in a way, they had a bit better conditions than other prisoners, because the Jews, the people who were in the camp, their hair was shorn so that there would not be lice, you know, in the hair. They had to wear a prisoner uniform. Now, because Mengele didn't want them harmed, he let them have their own clothes, because ordinary prisoners' clothes will not fit them because they were so small. He needed their hair for his experiment, so they had still their hair. And he also wanted them as kind of curiosity, as showbiz. There were still his living dolls, and he often brought SS men and other doctors to see them or to examine them. So he asked them to be always made up and with their hair done. So in a way, they were part show business people. The other part was guinea pigs.
So, I mean, how long did this process of experimentation go on for? How many months are we talking?
They arrived on May 19th. The camp was liberated January 27th, 1945. I think Mengele left a month earlier. So it's about a good 7 months. They also were afraid of what's going to be the next step. So one of the things that they really feared, that it was a mixture of dwarves and people of average height, members of the family and other people from the village who joined them. And they were afraid that the girls were in the group and the young women who were with them, Mengele will turn their womb into a laboratory, forcing them to have sex with the male dwarves to see what's going to be the offspring of this pregnancy. So they very much feared this next step. And Mengele did various sexual experiments on other dwarves in the camp, and they fear that this is going to be the next step. And again, Perla told us that, yes, Mengele said that I have worked for 20 years. It doesn't mean that he needs us for 20 years. He can finish the work on us in a year or so, and then the next step will be to kill us and skeletonize us and send our skeletons to be presented in anthropological museum in Berlin. And she said this was the most frightening thing. We accepted the fact that we are not going to get alive from the camp, that we'll sooner or later will be killed like the rest of the Jews who arrived at Auschwitz. But the idea that our bodies, that our skeleton, our bones will be presented for years to come in a museum, and people will come and stare at us, that's something that it was impossible to tolerate. So it was kind of a constant fear. You were leaving from one day to another, hoping that somehow there would be a miracle and it will be over.
What happened to the family as the war came to an end?
The war came to an end for them in January 1945, and with the people, with the average height people in their group, which were altogether 23, they almost walked in the snow. The tall people served as human horses, and they pulled a bread cart with the dwarves on it, and they managed to get to Krakow, and then afterwards they got a train, and they arrived at the village about 8 months later. Everything was looted, and they felt that there was no reason to stay in the village because most of the Jews had been killed, and it was really too painful. And it took them about 2 more years in Europe until they decided to go to Israel, which has just been established. Just before May 1949, they got an invitation from an impresario to go to New York, and another invitation from a Russian, from the Russians to join the Bolshoi, but they said that they would not want to be anymore among non-Jews, and they decided to go to Israel, and they arrived in May 1949. And 3 months afterwards, they were already on stage performing in the largest halls in Israel, halls where the Israeli Philharmonic had appeared. And they, in spite of everything they had been through, they were strong enough to resume their life and to be triumphant. And for 5 more years, they continued touring the land and performing, and then they began to be, some of them became quite old, and they were the tolls of the camp also, it took their toll on their health, so they retired, and then they bought 2 cinemas, and for the next 15 years they operated the cinemas and continued living together in the same house like they did before.
That was Yehuda Koren and Eilat Negev. Their book, Giants, The Dwarves of Auschwitz, The Extraordinary Story of the Lilliput Troop, is out now, published by the Robson Press. And now we have a short advert.
For 20 years, the exploits of Marcus Didius Falco have captivated readers. Now, Lindsay Davis brings us The Ides of April, the start of a major new series featuring Falco's adopted daughter, Flavia Albia, who, in defiance of tradition, has taken up the family business. It is festival time in ancient Rome. The games of Ceres are about to begin. But as people get ready to celebrate, a killer prepares his slaughter ground. When news of strange deaths all over the city reach Flavia Albia, she must tear herself away from a new love affair to hunt down the murderer. The Ides of April is out now in all good bookshops.
Before our next interview, I'd like to quickly remind you that our April issue is still on sale. It's a Tudor special where we delve into the downfall of Anne Boleyn, consider how the Spanish Armada might have succeeded, and then sit down for a Tudor-style breakfast. Plus, we explore life in a Roman home, revisit a key tank battle in the Second World War, and discover some of the finest Norman churches. Our April issue is on sale now in all good newsagents and, of course, in our many digital formats. When we think of the Vikings in Britain, the popular image is often one of hostility and violence. But there was another side to relations between the Norse invaders and the people who they conquered. Oxford historian Yanina Ramirez has been researching the cultural impact of the Vikings in Britain.
Do you feel that our view of Vikings
in Britain, and I caught up with her recently to find out more,
a bit overly concerned with all this killing and pillaging and things like that?
I really do. I feel very passionate about this, actually. I think that the way that English history has been written, the way that the textbooks tell us it plays out, is that the Vikings are this sort of anomaly, these raiders that come and leave. And there is this emphasis on the symbolism of the longboat bringing them in and taking them away again. But that really is very far from the truth. If we think about the Anglo-Saxons in comparison, when we talk about the way that the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes came over from the Germanic homelands and settled in the British Isles, it is really termed a settlement. It is seen as, you know, that the population, the native population, were profoundly influenced by these incomers, and they changed the complexion of the British Isles on the back of that. But we don't have the same sense of transformation when in the way that people talk about the Viking impact. They did stay, they did settle, they did intermarry, they profoundly affected the genetic makeup of the British Isles and the cultural and social and political makeup as well. And I really think that that is something that gets underplayed time and again. There's this sense of the Viking being something alien, and the word Viking itself coming with all these associations of barbarism and paganism. But they weren't a race as such. The word Viking doesn't refer to a place. It refers to an activity, going a Viking. And it's perhaps more accurate to talk about Norsemen, more people of the Norse, rather, because you have Vikings coming from Denmark, Vikings coming from Norway. This is not a racial term. And yet I think it has come to be seen as a racial term by future, later historians talking about their impact on the British Isles. It's these foreign others that come, destroy the British Isles and go back to these distant homelands.
So do you believe the Vikings have been unfairly targeted? Is it fair to say that they were no more damaging in that sense than, say, the Anglo-Saxons or the Normans?
It's a difficult one. I do think they were very damaging. I do think certainly the waves of destruction that were targeted at the coastlines, at the monasteries, at sort of vulnerable locations, they were devastating. And I think this idea of perhaps this religious and cultural difference between these groups of sort of settled Anglo-Saxon Christians and these raiding, trading, military pagans, their worldviews, their outlooks were so completely different that it was a clashing of cultures that has this very destructive aspect to it. Whether it is more or less destructive than any sort of raiding or settlement is difficult to determine, but the fact that their legacy has been written down by the Christians that they destroyed or damaged has coloured that sort of legacy profoundly. The language used by Christian monks and Christian scholars to write about the Viking attacks is incredibly moving, incredibly passionate and colourful. And because we have these accounts, that has lasted as an echo down through the ages of how dark and destructive these attacks were. I think any sort of any settlement and raiding mission must have had a very destructive aspect to it, but the Vikings have had this sort of caricature carved out for them in the art and in the literature by those people that they attacked. It's that history is written by the victors cliche, isn't it? But that's how we know about them, and that's how they've been carved into history. I think what happened after the initial Viking attacks is different again. I think there is There's so much evidence for settlement, quite peaceful settlement, coexistence, this idea that they were able to integrate themselves with the native Anglo-Saxon people, that they took on board things like building high stone crosses, weirdly. But they did actually mould themselves. There was a sense of syncretism going on. They were able to mould and adapt to the people that they were now living alongside. And that aspect of the Viking these so-called Viking invasions, is far less dramatic and destructive. It's actually quite peaceful. But alongside that, you get the movement of the Great Army, these battles being fought by these fearsome warriors in massive numbers, really, for the time. So that aspect never really goes away. The destructive, violent aspect never fully goes away. But it's a very complicated one. And it's complicated in as much as we have some evidence, but not enough. That's different, perhaps, to the settlement of the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes, where we have virtually no evidence, and we have to piece it together with very little. With the Vikings, the evidence we have colours our understanding of it completely.
This idea of violence and invasion, was that part of the Viking culture that they brought to Britain?
I think so. I think we can't get away from the fact that the Viking worldview was distinctly different from Anglo-Saxon England, where it was around sort of the 8th, 9th century. Go back to the 6th century and there would have been far more in common. But since St. Augustine, 597, and the arrival of Christianity and this sort of missionary fervour with which Anglo-Saxons converted to Christianity, these different people pulled apart in terms of their imaginative worlds and also in terms of how they structured their societies. The Anglo-Saxons were... Their society was modelled more on the sort of patterns of kingship that you see on the Christian continent. So there was a greater degree of bureaucracy, which was coupled with literacy, so paperwork. And then this idea of a spiritual framework, an afterlife that rewards people who are pious, who are humble, kind, these sorts of aspects, that is rewarded. That's very different to the Viking worldview, if we can use that term of you know, collectively of Vikings. Truer to speak more of the people of the north, the Scandinavian people. Their worldview was conditioned more by their pagan religion, in which warrior and the prestige of a warrior, the ability to fight, to be heroic, to get wealth and prestige and power, that was all celebrated within their religion. So the ultimate area of the afterlife that warriors wanted to get to was Valhalla, where you would feast and fight for all eternity. And little things like the idea that you're buried with no grave goods in a Christian burial because you don't need them. Everything you need will be taken care of by this divine and magnanimous God afterwards. That's very different to the pagan worldview, where you take your finest armor, you take your horse, you take food, you take your clothes with you into the afterlife because it's an extension of that life on earth. It's a better version, but it is not otherworldly. It is just the next world, if you like. And so I think these spiritual aspects have conditioned the relationship between the Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings, but also their political way of thinking of the world. The Viking tribes were still organized much more like the earlier Anglo-Saxons and Jutish tribes were, with a lord who has loyal followers within the hall, within the comitatus, that are loyal to him and will fight for him. And that there is a sense of greater political hierarchy developing over the course of the 8th and 9th century in Scandinavia. But there are still these disparate leaders, lots of different warriors and leaders. That's in contrast to Anglo-Saxon England, where you are seeing a much more rigid hierarchy coming into place, where a king is at the top and those people are loyal to him, pay him taxes, and he is supported by the bureaucracy and by the church. So I think you have a clash of people, very much, a clash of worldviews and a clash of outlooks. And because the Vikings weren't writing down their experience of their encounters in the British Isles, their voice has been lost, whereas these Christian Anglo-Saxons are able to make these very impassioned pleas down through the centuries that still are very evocative and resonate.
And a lot of Viking cultural aspects, and certainly linguistic ones, have survived into later English and British history. Mm. Would you say they were more imposed by the Vikings on an unwilling population, or was it a shared assimilation period? Did the local people take on some Viking ideas willingly?
I think there was a sense of willingness, yes. I think when you think quite how extensive the influence of the Danelaw was, for example, how much of the British Isles was directly indebted to Scandinavia, were paying debts to them, that really shows that everything down almost to the Thames was influenced in terms of culture, fashion, language. These settlers, these Viking settlers, they were setting up villages and they were intermarrying with the native population. And so their effect was going to be felt in terms of the language that people spoke and the way people communicated. There was a mutual intelligibility to some extent between Old English and Old Norse. But what we see linguistically is the introduction of more Old Norse loanwords, and certainly in the north of the country, a drift towards more sort of Norse inflections and treatment of the language and accent as well. I think when you think about the very most northernmost isles, the Shetlands and the Orkneys, they were considered the Sutherland for certainly for the Norwegian Vikings. And there, the accent and the language was becoming very close to that spoken in Norway at the time. Culturally, I think that it was quite reciprocal. I think that because Vikings were put in positions of power, they made themselves the landowners and the lords of the manor, if you like. They were holding the upper sort of strata of power. They were the most powerful within society at that time. And they were wealthy as well. They traded widely. They were able to acquire the material wealth of the places that they inhabited. So the way that they dressed, the way they ate, the way, you know, the things that entertained them, that was high society. So the people wanting to adhere with this sort of this level of society, maybe lower down the social rungs, these Anglo-Saxons that were had Vikings as their overlords, would start to dress like Vikings, would start to enjoy the same things. And so there's this sense in which the Anglo-Saxons did copy Viking fashions and tastes. But I think it turns the other way too. So I mentioned earlier about stone high crosses. They're a very good example of how the Vikings took an Anglo-Saxon art form and bent it to their own ends. So the high cross up until the 8th or 9th century was used as a statement of Christian power and authority. They were almost like miniature churches, and you see carved on the side of them these narratives from the Bible, from the lives of saints, alongside Latin inscriptions. And they were used, set in stone on the landscape, to show that the church was there, the church was permanent. People could go to that cross to have the sacraments and to hear Mass. There must have been quite a lot of them, particularly in the north of England. I think they must have populated the landscape to an extent. The Viking settlers must have noticed them, must have realized that they were important, significant as meeting places, as, you know, these beacons on the landscape. And so instead of destroying them, seeing them as some sort of Christian threat, they actually assimilate the form of the stone high cross, but they put mythological scenes on them from their own pagan religion. So you see images of Thor fishing for the world serpent, or Odin hanging on the tree of knowledge. And these, this is a really interesting exchange of culture and art. And I do think it shows that it was reciprocal. Then you look at finds of silver metalwork, even from right down in Wessex, in what was Anglo-Saxon Wessex. When you look at the art of Wessex in the time of King Alfred, there are brooches, there are necklaces, there are bits of silverware that you can see have taken their style and their influence to some extent from the Vikings. And that's in that last bastion of sort of Anglo-Saxon Christianity, Wessex. Even there, you see that there was this exchange of cultures.
So even though the Vikings came over as invaders, they didn't necessarily see themselves as culturally superior to the people they were conquering.
Culturally superior is interesting. In a way, I think there was a sense, I think there would have been a sense amongst the heroic warriors, the heroic warrior elite of the Viking settlers, that actually they were superior to the Anglo-Saxons. I think they saw Christian piety and Christian ideals as weak. I think they saw them as, celebrating these human virtues that actually don't help you in battle. They don't help you to defeat people like them, who are incredibly strong, trained killers, if you like, these warriors who prize their victory in battle above all things. So in that respect, I think there might have been a sense that, you know, people like King Alfred were maybe a weak king, that the people who rolled over and offered to pay the Dangeld in order to secure their land, that they were weak. They didn't stand up and fight. They would rather pay for the Vikings to go away. But because we don't have written evidence, it's impossible to know how superior they saw themselves. And a lot of this is extrapolating from finds, from burials, and from these ideas of greater things like their worldview. But I think that the Anglo-Saxons that wrote down these accounts of the Vikings certainly saw themselves as superior to them. They saw the Viking invaders very much as bloodthirsty wolves, these sort of animalistic base humans that just showed no compassion, showed no mercy, just destroyed and stole from these places of spiritual richness. When you look at Alcuin's letter, when he describes the attacks on Lindisfarne, it really is this idea of bloodthirsty wolves shedding these sacred stones with blood of saints. So in terms of who thought, how they considered themselves superior to one another, I think it was reciprocal. I think both sides considered themselves superior, but the Vikings really did achieve an awful lot and defeat an awful lot of Anglo-Saxon rulers. Alfred gets the term the Great because he did actually stop the Viking settlement from absorbing the entire entire expanse of Anglo-Saxon England. But it was still a relationship that depended on treaties, on keeping the Vikings sweet, if you like. So I think the Vikings do come out on top a lot of the time.
But so even though there was this mutual hostility, it didn't preclude cultural exchange and linguistic exchange.
I think there was hostility, and because of the nature of the Viking raids, that in the first wave there was a sense that they came and went away again, and they did take back plunder, slaves, and they didn't integrate so much with the native population. There must have been a great degree of hostility on the back of that. But once these larger numbers of Vikings were starting to settle, I think that changed the relationship and the dynamic. Once they were setting up workshops, homes, families, once they were starting to intermarry, I think then that mutual hostility did turn into, to some extent in some areas, a sense of living alongside one another and beginning to understand one another's cultures and languages better. So when you look at Jorvik, for example, up in York, there you have a sense in which the old York ceases to be of relevance. Jorvik, where the Vikings settled further up along the river, that is actually where they set up almost a new town. And it's a town where the native population and the settled Vikings work alongside one another. And they find things that are mutually beneficial. All people need blacksmiths. They need clothing, leather working. They need places to live. And so rather than talking about these high ideals of religion and politics, on a very human level, people can live alongside one another, even if there is there is a sense in which they need to work harder to understand each other's languages or cultures. So, I think that the Vikings within a century had integrated, certainly in the northern part of the country, very well. And that is why I'm always upset by this idea of the Vikings being seen as other, as simply these aggressors that came and went. They became us, and it's hard to even strictly speak of Anglo-Saxons from this point onwards, because they are this sort of Anglo-Saxon Viking hybrid. Not all of the population, but some of it, quite a lot of it. And it really flags up for me quite how multicultural and diverse the British Isles always has been. It always has been a place where people have come and settled and changed the complexion of the population and the culture and the art and the language. So you have the Romans, you have the Celts, you have the Anglo-Saxons, you have the Vikings, you have the Normans, and so it goes on and on. And I always find that an exciting thing to enjoy rather than to worry about. I think it is interesting to think about the Vikings' impact on us genetically, our own kind of heritage, culturally, artistically, and in terms of our DNA.
That was Dr. Yanina Ramirez. You can find out more about her work at her website, which is yaninaramirez.co.uk. And if you'd like to know more about Viking culture, then you might want to check out the exhibition Vikings, The Untold Story, at National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh,
More details of that at nms.ac.uk. And that is almost all for this week. Do let us know what you think. We're on email, podcast@historyextra.com. You can also keep in touch with us on social media, Twitter, we're at History Extra, facebook.com/historyextra. And to keep up with all our latest blogs, quizzes, galleries and more, visit our website, historyextra.com. Next time, we'll be broadcasting one of the lectures from our recent First World War Day, so make sure you tune in and download for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.